on Health and Human Services to order. And just a bit of information, committee, something everybody knows about, but we haven't talked about it in this committee. We are convening work groups starting Monday night, four nights a week for the next 3 weeks, alternate nights on Oregon Health Plan and Mental Health Delivery System. The legislative members on the Oregon Health Plan work group are myself, Representative Westland, Representative Bates, Senator Winters, and Senator Carter. Many stakeholders are involved. On the mental health side, it's myself, Representative Winters, Representative Westland, Representative Bates, and Senator Gordley. And again, many stakeholders involved. You may start getting some stuff about people that are concerned about the makeup of the group or what we're doing. By design, the numbers are manageable at this point. We're on the front end of this thing, but if you have too big of a group, you can't be real productive, and we have a very short timeline here. We have been requested by the co-chairs to try to develop a 30,000-foot view of the amount of money that needs to be in the budget to do at least the basics in both of those categories. And so that's the purpose of these groups. And you can tell people that all that the products of those groups will come before one of three committees. They will be fully vetted, and everybody will have a full chance to participate in the committee process before any finished product goes out. So that's just a little heads up, something that you can respond to constituents or people that call you. I have been getting a fair amount of email on the subject myself, so just a heads up. And with that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2487. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, this is a bill brought forward by House Bill 2487, as brought forward by the Oregon Association for Home Care. Representative Billy Dalto is the chief sponsor of the bill. This bill is basically doing two things. It's eliminating the requirement that non-skilled homes that employ non-skilled workers don't require a second licensure, which became effective February 1 of 03. That's it. I'm sorry. It doesn't do two things. It does that.
Well, it gets simpler as we go. Joan English?
Maybe I'll...
Oh, and Sarah? And does Grant want to come with them for save time? We have three chairs. We've got three people signed up. Works out really well. Good morning, and please proceed in whatever order you choose.
Have two microphones.
Yeah.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Reeder. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Association for Home Care. Our office is located here in Salem, Oregon at 1249 Commercial Street Southeast. We are here today to encourage your favorable consideration of House Bill 2487. As Sandy mentioned, the bill does actually do two things. one of the first things it does is eliminate the requirement for a dual license. And by that, what we mean is that currently there are now two statutes governing two different types of home care services. Under the Home Health Agency statute, which is the statute that is amended by this bill, it will incorporate the allowance for home health agencies to provide what are called non-skilled personal care services that are things such as bathing, housekeeping, assistance with mobility, those kinds of things, whereas prior to this time, there has been no ability by the home health under the home health license to provide this service. It's been done under a separate business entity. The new licensure for in-home care requires that home health agencies also apply under that license because of an interpretation with the rule. So at this point, the allowance one to provide personal care services would now be included under our home health license, and we would there would be an elimination of the requirement to apply for two licenses, one under home health and one under in-home care. I've brought with me Joan English, who's the director of Salem Hospital Home Care, to speak a little bit about how it is currently structured and why it's necessary that we eliminate the requirement for the two licenses. We've provided some talking points for you as well as some background on the issue, and I'd be happy to get into that further if you have further questions.
Right. Sarah, go ahead.
Good morning. Again, for the record, my name is Joan English, and I'm the director of Salem Hospital Home Care. And any questions you would have, I'm happy to answer. From our perspective, I would say I could, in representing the Oregon Association for Home Care, speak for not just my agency, but other agencies that are similar to mine who are hospital-based home health providers. At Salem Hospital Home Care, our structure is that we are a home care provider, and under that home care umbrella, we provide the home health services and in-home care services. We call that community-based services. At this time, we have a license through the hospital for home care. What we would be required to do as it stands now with in-home care is we would then be required to get another license for the in-home care part of home care. Under the home care license right now, we have surveyors from the health division who come and survey us either annually unannounced or I think the limit is they can wait for up to 3 years to come and survey us. We're with this additional requirement right now, then we would have a license for the in-home care. That would mean that the health division would also come and survey us unannounced for the in-home care services. To us, this appears redundant, not just to mention the financial implications of a second license. It would seem to me logically that it would be as if a hospital would be required to have a separate license for every single service they provide, which is not the case. So I'm requesting in representation of our members that the committee look at this from a logical standpoint, that two licenses for basically very similar services is not necessary. We are also surveyed, as most home care agencies are, by the Joint Commission of Accreditation for Hospitals. And the Joint Commission for Accreditation of Hospitals surveys in one process all services that they define as home care, which in-home care is defined as home care as well as home health is defined as home care. They do not charge us two fees to come and do that survey. They charge us one fee for home care, and I think that model is more appropriate.
Grant?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. First, happy Valentine's Day and happy birthday to the state of Oregon. For the record, I'm Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the state public health officer for the Department of Human Services, and we also support this bill. We have been licensing home health agencies for a number of years. But one thing that says in the statute is that home health care is for really curative and rehabilitative services, and that personal services are not covered under that license. Then a couple of sessions ago, Representative Sanceri asked for an in-home licensing program so that people who are providing more personal care services could become licensed and protect. There would be more protections than on the people that they served. Well, when we were developing the rules, our legal counsel said, since you have to be licensed to provide those personal care services, and because it specifically states that they are not part of home health, then these agencies would have to be dual licensed. if a home health agency was providing those personal care services. This dual licensure does not make sense to us either. We've worked with the industry to come up with language to correct this. We think that this is a good bill and would like to see it pass.
Questions?
I agree, Tom.
Thank you very much. I think you've done your homework, and this makes perfect sense to me. And so thank you for your testimony. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2487 and open a work session on House Bill 2487.
Mr. Chair, I move that we send House Bill 2487 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2487 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Excused.
Representative Belto.
Aye.
Representative
Von Anderson.
Aye.
Representative
Tomei.
Aye.
Representative
Weston. Excused.
Chair Cruz.
Cruz votes aye. House Bill 2487, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Dalto, this was your bill. Do you want to carry it or put it on consent? I give you the discretion.
I think we should put it on the consent.
Okay, Representative Dalto moves House Bill 2487 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2487 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2245. Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2247.
45.
Excuse me, 2245. Brought forward at the request of the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board. The bill is requesting an increase in the licensing period from 1 year for occupational therapists from 1 year to 2 years. It's modifying the established license fee, which is currently $75 in statute, modifying it to establish the board to determine the licensing and renewal fees, and it modifies the current position of executive secretary to director, and it has an effective date beginning June 1, 2004.
Jeff.
Good morning, Chair Cruz and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jeff Rome. I'm a public member on the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board. I'm here to request your support for House Bill 2245. To summarize, House Bill 2245 will provide the following. Increase the licensing period from 1 year to 2 years. Require the board to establish license and license renewal fees. Remove reinstatement fees. And redesignate the executive secretary title to director. I'll briefly discuss the rationale for each of these four provisions. First, the board is proposing changing the licensing period from 1 year to 2 years. Biennial licensing will reduce workload associated with license renewals for both licensees, board members, and for staff. Also, the two-year license reporting period allows greater flexibility for our licensees to obtain their required continuing education. I might explain. Current regulation requires 15 points of continuing education for licensees each year, and continuing education is also tied to our license renewal cycles. The board has met with licensees and been made aware of a need to expand the time period for completing continuing education. A two-year period allows more time to participate in relevant CE, and furthermore, some licensees could then choose to dedicate a concentrated period of time for updating their professional skills over the longer two-year cycle. The final rationale for this provision is that the board should realize approximately $2,600 in savings through going to a two-year license cycle. House Bill 2245 also requires the board to establish license and renewal fees. Some of the fees are currently in statute. And the board is requesting authority to adopt fees through the administrative legislative process, which brings the process in line with other health-related licensing boards and allows for flexibility to deal with unforeseen circumstances. This fee process ensures continued legislative oversight in that any fees adopted must be approved by DAS and ratified by the Legislative Assembly. This bill also removes the statutory requirement for reinstatement fees. Currently, licensees whose license has lapsed for less than 3 years are obliged to pay back fees when they renew their licenses. Persons whose licenses have elapsed also have to make up continuing education credits, and there are additional costs associated with satisfying these credits. The number of elapsed licenses who renew is small, but reinstatement fees may present a real hardship to persons who have not worked for the past few years. We estimate a loss of revenue of about $1,000 annually through this provision. House Bill 2245 also redesignates Executive Secretary to Director to update and more clearly reflect current responsibilities. Thank you. I'd be glad to respond to any questions you might have.
Questions?
Yeah.
Representative Sanderson.
Thank you. How do I, and maybe we need someone from the license board to be here, but I'm concerned primarily with not having a reinstatement fee. I mean, as a nurse, you know, if we don't renew, man, we get our license removed. We can't practice. We can't do anything.
Right.
And it seems like this would provide more.
I can clarify that. I think that's a misread. There is a reinstatement fees, and all the delinquent fees need to be repaid. But we're deleting that part where they have to pay the fees for the years they haven't practiced. In other words, presently, if you are out for 3 years, you have to pay your license fees for all those 3 years and also make up the continuing education that you've missed. And we felt that there is a reinstatement fee, but to require them to pay for periods where they were unlicensed was excessive. And so the board discussed it and decided that we should recommend to delete that.
Paula? Yeah. Have you ever thought about just having an inactive status where I know that...
Well, I'll introduce Peggy Smith, who's here. She's the executive director. And the reason is I'm not aware of the fact that we may have an inactive status already, and this is something totally different. This is Mrs. Smith.
Good morning, Chair Crows and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Smith, and I'm the executive officer to the OT Licensing Board. We do not have an inactive status for licenses, and persons who renew after the deadline do have to pay a delinquent fee, a $50 delinquent fee, and we're not proposing to eliminate that fee. We are proposing that persons who have not, it's not only they have not been working, but their license also has lapsed. I mean, I'm assuming that those are hand in hand. And if they have not been working and their license has lapsed for like 2 years, the current license fee is $85, and they would have to pay twice $85 in order to renew a lapsed license in addition to the $50 late fee.
So say someone then hadn't practiced for about 4 or 5 years. Would they then be able to start practicing without having, do you have requirements for education or upgrading their licenses? I'm just trying to think of,
Chair Cruz and Representative Monty Sanderson. The current statute says that persons may renew a lapsed license up to 3 years by paying the back fees. If it's more than 3 years, they reapply. They are not renewing a lapsed license. Their license is dead. But in order for them to come into the profession again or qualify for a license, they have to make up, if it's been more than 3 years, they have to make up 45 points of continuing education and complete a mentorship unless they have maintained a license in another state. Some people do have licenses in other states, and that license is current, in which case they don't have to make up CE and they don't have to pay those back fees.
Thank you.
Yeah, that sounds fairly similar to the registered nursing refresher program. Thanks.
Any questions?
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Wesley. Sweet nothings.
It is Valentine's Day.
So. I don't know where that came from. Any other questions?
Yes.
Yes, Representative Mona Sanderson.
And again, it's out of my realm of knowledge here regarding the amount of impact it would have on our revenue. And
well, Representative, it'd have an impact on the revenue to the board. Estimated $1,000, but there would be administrative savings of almost three times that. So I think it's a net gain, as I understand it. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
They're getting more efficient, Mr. Chair.
And we appreciate that. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We close public hearing on 2245 and open a work session on House Bill 2245.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2245 to the floor with a repass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2245 to the floor with a repass recommendation. Any discussion? I will say for the committee's benefit, because I said just the other day anything that had any dollars tied to it would go to Ways and Means. I'm not sure that in the light of $2 billion, $1,000 is significant. But I will run this by the co-chair, but just to make sure he understands what we're doing here.
But it doesn't go to the general fund, does it?
No, it does not. But they want all fee bills and all those things down there. I think this falls even under that window.
Hmm.
So in talking to Representative Westland, who has some Ways and Means experience, a little bit. He thought it was appropriate to send it to the floor and then just inform the co-chair of what we're doing.
Good.
So that would be my intent with this.
Good.
Did you have a question, Representative Anderson?
No, just a comment that I think this tightens up the one of our many boards, and it's a good move to make it more efficient.
Yeah.
Representative Westland.
I wish more boards would come to us with, you know, this very collaborative, proactive, you know, type of involvement. Addressing some of their own needs, making our job easier, reducing administrative costs on us. I mean, look, you got to do this every session. Look at the time we're burning up right now, you know, as opposed to doing it every year. So, no, this is a good bill. I don't know who came up with it. Good idea.
Okay, seeing no further discussion, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Excused.
Representative Delto?
Aye.
Representative
Montesanderson.
Aye.
Representative
Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Westland.
Aye.
Chair. Aye. House Bill 2245, having received the required majority, is declared passed.
Do you think this could go on the consent calendar, Mr. Chair?
It would suit me to a T.
Great.
Representative Tomei moves that House Bill 2245 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2245. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2251. Grant. You want to come up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ken, do you want to? Okay. Good anticipation.
Chair.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Public Health Officer with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2251 and also in support of some amendments that we would like to see drafted and added to this bill as well. As I think we all realize, September 11th, 2001, and the anthrax attacks that followed in October of that year really changed our world forever. And one thing that became clear is that at both the state and at the national level, that laws really were inadequate to fully protect the safety of the population. So one of the initiatives that took place over the next several months following those attacks was a number of states, including Oregon, started looking at laws. Our governor's Security Council, which is the group convened by Governor Kitzhaber to deal with bioterrorism and other terrorist potentialities, asked the Attorney General if he would look at existing laws and decide, are there areas that we need to identify and work on to help further protect the citizens of Oregon. So the Department of Justice identified over 250 potential legislative issues through that review, and then through an extended process involving state agency heads, local partners, and a number of other folks, came up and narrowed that listing down to what we believed were 15 critical issues. Those 15 critical issues then were given out to a number of different work groups to look at. And four of the issues, because they were health or public health related, went to the Health Preparedness Advisory Committee. The Health Preparedness Advisory Committee is a broad-based group that we at the Department of Human Services pulled together to provide us advice on our bioterrorism and public health preparedness grants. So the four issues that the HPAC, or Health Preparedness Advisory Committee, looked at were quarantine and isolation. That was number one. Second was licensing, liability, and credentialing. The third was access to medical records. And the fourth was public health alert. The HPAC, at their most recent meeting, recommended that all four of these issues move forward through the legislative process for discussion by the legislature. And House Bill 2251 addresses this issue of a public health alert, and what it does is authorize the governor to declare a state of impending health crisis, which is short of declaring an emergency. We believe that there are situations that pose a potential health threat but do not really warrant an immediate health emergency declaration. However, those less severe situations we believe could benefit by providing public health authorities to have some additional powers to do actions that are not currently available. Some of the actions that we suggest that we would like to see are things like adopting new reporting procedures for healthcare providers, for instance, reporting discolored large lymph nodes if we thought that plague was something that was possibly going to be hitting Oregon in the near future. Another power would be to create diagnostic and treatment standards so that if we were short on ciprofloxacin for treating potential anthrax cases, we could come up with standards that said that you are to treat with ciprofloxacin only if there has been a documented exposure to a credible threat. Isolating mass groups and quarantining those groups is another issue we think would be important to have in those situations. Potentially having access to medical records and being able to mobilize healthcare providers to help us with issues such as mass vaccination would be another action that we think is reasonable in those situations. And one of the reasons we think this is important is because a number of these things we would have used in the anthrax attacks in the fall of 2001, even though we did not actually have any true anthrax cases here in Oregon. It can be argued that the governor, in his existing powers and ORS 401, does have the authority to do any and all of these things. In fact, much more power is given to the governor. However, one reason we think it's important to have this bill is that in the fall of 2001, when anthrax was raging, not raging, but anthrax was present on the East Coast, and at a time when over 30,000 people were being on prophylaxis for potential exposure, and the national pharmaceutical stockpile was activated and brought mass quantities of medications to states, no state governor declared a state of emergency. And it's just, we think, too gross of a tool, and think that we need to have another more effective, less dramatic tool to be able to use in our tool case. An argument can also be made, and I think you will hear this argument being made by the Oregon Medical Association, that this bill allows the state to declare a public health, impending public health crisis in non-critical situations, or could be used that way. And they believe that it's going to potentially give the state public health officer too sweeping of powers. And this was not the intent of the bill. You know, we put in the language that would only be invoked if there were the possibility of widespread, life-threatening issues that were beyond existing capabilities. And the activities that we've outlined are really trying to get us towards restricting us to only those things that we think are the most important tools that we would need, and only to be used when they're specifically directed at those disease entities that we're trying to prevent. But we recognize that there is some conflict on the current wording of the bill, and would be very happy to sit down with OMA and other groups to revise that wording to see if we can come up with something that is more satisfactory in the way of language. In addition to the public health alert piece, there were also two other issues that we would like to see inserted into this bill, but I don't have language for you here today. One of them is quarantine. Clearly, with a bioterrorist attack, there's a potential for having the need to isolate and quarantine large numbers of people. Right now in Oregon, we think we have good quarantine laws when we're talking about a single individual, but we don't think we have nearly so clear laws when we're talking about mass quarantine. Clearly, personal freedoms would have to be protected, and any language, we will make sure that it states it's clearly defined who can be vaccinated, those vulnerable populations, or those populations that have been exposed to a communicable disease. Another amendment that we would like to see discussed deals with access to medical records. In the case of an infectious disease emergency, we can see the potential for us needing to look at hundreds or thousands of records to try to do a quick epidemiological investigation of a particular disease. And our concern is that already there are some potential barriers when it comes to confidentiality laws at both the national and the state level, and particularly with HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. We're concerned that those are going to be more of a problem for us if we had this need, and so we would like that clear authority to be able to do that. So those are the two additional amendments that we would like to see done, and again, we would like the committee to authorize us to work with Legislative Council and the other groups that I've mentioned to come up with language that's acceptable to all. We would again involve OMA, the Hospital Association, and the Civil Liberty Advocates in that work. And then the final, fourth issue I mentioned that the Health Preparedness Advisory Committee took a look at was the whole issue of liability, licensing, and credentialing. We continue to think that this is a very critical issue. There is a separate bill, though, House Bill 2410, that is now in general government that we think is the appropriate vehicle to be dealing with that, so I'm not bringing that before you. And then finally, the last thing is we just very recently found from our immunization program They came up with a concern, and their concern was that if we do ever need to have mass vaccinations of the entire population, like for something like smallpox, we would like to be able to use the existing data management systems that we have in order to track the immunization work that we're doing. And right now we have the immunization alert, which is that kind of registry, but the enabling legislation for that immunization alert says it's only for people age 0 to 18. So we would also like to have an amendment that says that at least in emergency situations, we would extend that to people of all ages. And with that, I'll close and happy to answer questions, or you might want to hear from Mr. Murphy first.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm so glad that you've come here with some of these ideas, because I know that at the national level they're very concerned about weapons and nuclear bombs and that, but I feel where the war really will be is in terrorism. That's just how those, I think, seem to work. And if we don't have a way to really react quickly, you know, we could have a lot of deaths. So I just commend you. I need some clarification on access to medical records. What is the barrier now? I mean, how do you see the barrier if we had an outbreak?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, first in responding to your first question, I think that you're absolutely right, and the whole issue around the orange alert and the fact that basically what they're saying is it could be a number of things. You know, we know that we will be hit by terrorism again, and exactly what it will be, where it will be, we don't know, and so we feel that we do need to have a number of tools to be able to work with that and respond quickly. Specifically on the issue of medical records, appropriately, medical records are confidential. You know, we in public health should not be able to look at those records unless there are specific reasons for us for doing so. You know, we do have a number of reporting requirements, so we do have the ability to get sensitive medical record information in a number of specific cases. We can see, however, the possibility, and just as an example, you know, we identify six people with an illness that we don't know what it is, but it's a very severe illness, and a number of those people have already been hospitalized. The one thing that we see that's consistent among all those patients is that they were all seen at one clinic over a two-day period. You know, we at that point very likely would want to go into that clinic and take a look at a whole lot of records to see whether or not we can see other people who had the same kind of illnesses, whether we can identify an index case, those kind of things. Us going to a place, a healthcare facility, and saying we need you to open up your records for us to review 100 or 200 cases, they may say, you know, we really can't do that. Where's the confidentiality protections? And particularly with HIPAA, you know, on the very near horizon, they may say this is something we just can't do. And so we would like to have in statute the authority to say, well, we recognize your concerns, but you know, this is a impending public health crisis, and the statute does give us the authority to do that. Clearly, disclosure of that information is something that has to be protected too, and that we would make sure is in the bill. Any information that we would look for and take away with us would only be information that's directly dealing with the disease and the preventing of that disease, and would only be disclosed to a limited number of appropriate people.
Thank you. We have reportable diseases. So when we have something like anthrax or some other bio agent that can kill people being distributed, somehow if they find out what it is, couldn't that be considered a reportable disease? I mean, is there a mechanism there that we can use existing law to make those records open? Because aren't they open if it's a reportable disease or not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mona Sanderson, the disease is reportable, but not necessarily our authority to go in and look at that patient's record. And another issue is that sometimes we're talking about cases that we don't even know what the disease is yet. And that's another issue with the, you know, reporting requirements. Right now we can, for a disease, you know, say that Ebola virus is now reportable, and we can do an emergency rule very quickly on that. What we can't do, though, is what's called a syndromic reporting. So if we thought that we had potential bubonic plague coming to the state of Oregon, plague's reportable right now. But the symptom of a plague, which is oftentimes a large, swollen, discolored lymph node, that's not reportable. But under this, we could make that kind of syndrome reportable and therefore be able to start identifying the disease earlier.
Any other questions? Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Dr. Higginson, I guess in light of the reports, I guess, that are coming out of North Korea that they might be, you know, weaponizing some biological things. You know, another member expressed concern to me earlier this week that our public health response may not be adequate, and I just wanted to know how you'd characterize our public health response at this point, our readiness.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dalto, our readiness is much improved to what it was a year ago and substantially more improved than it was even a couple of years ago. A few years ago, we started receiving small amounts of dollars to be looking at bioterrorism. Basically, all those dollars stayed at the state level around some communicable disease work and laboratory enhancements at our public health laboratory, and then developing a health alert system, which is a telecommunication system primarily between state public health, the federal government, and our local public health department partners. After the fall of 2001 with those attacks, it was clearly recognized that public health really is a critical player in public safety and terrorism responses as well. And consequently, we received additional supplemental dollars to that grant we got for the time period June of 2002 through August of 2003, $14.2 million here in Oregon. So now we have substantially more dollars to be working on public health emergency preparedness in general, where we're making sure all of our health plans at both the state and local level are up to date, making sure that those are fully coordinated with emergency management, with state police, with local emergency management. We have substantially more new people at the state level, but primarily at the local level, about 50 new staff at the local level now, who are working on communicable disease surveillance and response activities, so that when diseases are identified at the local level, we can quickly figure out what those are, who's been exposed, and control those. Additional work's been done at the laboratory. Additional work's been done in our health alert network telecommunication systems. We're actually right now in the process of trying to select a vendor that will give us blast capacity so that we could get this kind of information out to thousands of healthcare providers across the state immediately. We're also doing some work on communications and making sure that as much as possible that we have things already developed so that if there were another attack of anthrax, we have the press releases already there and have figured out ways to get to special populations. And we're doing a lot of training and exercising on all of these issues as well. So I'd like to say that we're totally prepared. We're still preparing, but I think we're much more prepared than we are. The one qualifier, though, I would say is that no matter how prepared we are, we're never going to be prepared for everything. I mean, there are some situations that regardless are just going could potentially be so overwhelming that you could not respond to them adequately.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of us are relatively new. Tell me how the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act restricts. Is it in access to medical records? In what way would it restrict now as it's implemented?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the HIPAA is simply an extension of current confidentiality requirements. But because there is so much attention right now being paid to HIPAA and what you can and cannot disclose, there is a sense in the healthcare community as well as with state agencies that this is an issue that we really have to pay attention to. And if we don't, and are I'm not sure if convicted is the right word, but have violated HIPAA, then there are some real consequences. So it's something that I think that people are more and more going to say, you know, can I really give up this information and really seriously think through that release of information prior to giving it up.
And I'd point out, committee, that Representative Westland's audit committee is going to spend a full day on HIPAA next week. And two full days. Good, I couldn't do it in one. We'll get kind of a sense of what Grant's talking about at that point. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, remember when AIDS or HIV became known in the 80s and what fear there was to have that attached to your name or your record, and now, you know, there isn't the fear of AIDS like it was. The same thing is going to happen with whatever. I can foresee something like that happening again with, you know, being exposed to something, and then you're labeled and you're ostracized, and so there's a whole lot to this, so we have to really be careful how we handle it.
Right. And Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, I'm glad you raised that, because actually the issue of HIV came up last night at the OMA Legislative Committee meeting, where we had some discussion and some, as you will hear, disagreement on this bill. But someone said, you know, could if this had been in place, could we have used this impending public health crisis to say there was a crisis with AIDS? And then to do some of the things that you're talking about and inappropriately go in and be reviewing those people's records and inappropriately quarantining and isolating those people. And clearly that's not the intent of what we're trying to do here. And so we will work to make sure that it's restricted to a place where we're only dealing with those crises, impending crises that we think are critical to deal with on an immediate basis.
Okay. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly share Representative Mona Sanderson's concerns about the protection of privacy and how that might be misused. Dr. Hickinson, can you tell us how many people were harmed by the anthrax issue a couple of years ago?
Yeah, in the fall of 2002, there were 22 individuals. I think the total count was 22, but it was somewhere in the 20s, and 11 of those people died. All of those people died had inhalation anthrax. But as I mentioned, there were over 30,000 exposures that were felt to have been significant enough that those people needed to go on prophylactic antibiotics.
May seem unrelated, but how many people do you think die a day from the use of tobacco?
Representative Cruz, Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, I believe it's in Oregon right now. We estimate about 8,000 people a year die from tobacco-related illness.
The reason I ask that, Mr. Chair, not so much as a response to you, but I guess we have quite a few students here in the room. And I guess it's important to me that we keep all of this in context. It was a very small group of people that were affected by anthrax. It's an extremely large group that is affected by the use of tobacco. So if you want to protect yourselves and your country, please keep that in mind. Thank you.
And if I could respond to that, Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, I think that's an excellent point, and we do have to keep things in perspective. One of the things that I really like about the $14.2 million that we've recently received is that we've been told by the federal government and again by the legislature and by our congressional delegation that this is not money to build this system that waits around for emergencies to happen. This is something that's to build core public health communicable disease infrastructure. So not only are we using it for anthrax and the potential of smallpox, but we're using it for tuberculosis control, for the control of other naturally caused outbreaks, for influenza as well. So we really are trying to use this, these dollars effectively.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Getting back to Representative Monis Anderson's question, in terms of enforcement for those who abuse the confidentiality, I notice in Section 2.7 there are penalties, but that doesn't look like it refers to this. Is there any enforcement? People spread the word on things that they shouldn't be disclosing?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, those civil penalties were not around the disclosure issue, and I would have to look into to and see what penalties there are in the way of disclosure. But that's something we'll do and get back when we come back the next time.
Representative Wesley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To answer, I think more specifically, Representative Tomei's question and the 8,000 number, that's about 20 a day, just a little over 20, 21 a day. Those of you that see me chewing up here, I'm chewing nicotine gum. So if I can do it, speaking specifically to some of the guests we're honored with to have here today, you can do it. And so can you.
Yeah. These things don't go there.
Yeah.
You got it.
See, I set a good example.
In a very limited universe. But, Representative Dalton.
I believe the best example is by our youngest member who never started in the first place. So listen to these guys. Mr. Chair, if I may, Dr. Higginson, I just wanted to follow up on... That was weird. I just wanted to follow up on a point that Representative Tomei made, and that is how much do we spend a year or, I don't know, a year or in a biennium on smoking cessation and education and prevention programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto.
Hopefully that's $14 million.
Brittany?
More than
that. Well, in 1996, our tobacco education and prevention program started, and this was funded through a ballot initiative, ballot measure 44, I believe, that created increased tax on tobaccos. 90% of those dollars went to support the Oregon Health Plan. 10% come to state public health for tobacco prevention education. I believe that remains about $17 million a biennium, so about $8.5 million a year, and we think that that has been a very successful program, and believe that we have data to show that there have been substantial decreases in the number of people smoking and the number of cigarettes consumed, and particularly in the young adult population. And be happy to provide more information on our tobacco program if the committee is interested another time.
I appreciate the attack on the chair, but I would like to kind of get back to Phil if we could, and let Ken proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Emergency Management. And just wanted to provide a few comments in support of this bill. Dr. Higginson and I have talked about this and worked together on these different issues through the Health Policy Advisory Committee. And want to just say that this just gives Oregon another tool to deal with public health crisis. And also, as we expand into the world of terrorism, there's a lot more to deal with in public health crisis than just anthrax and smallpox. These recent events of the Orange Alert and all the different things going around have had many questions about chemical agents and those kind of things. And so I think it provides both the public health arena and the governor and state emergency management the ability, which is important to us through the declaration process, to quickly get a handle on a crisis before it really does turn into something. Because in any crisis, and using a public health one as an example, once a crisis starts, you have collateral issues. And if you have a smallpox outbreak, that may be the initial crisis, but then you, if you can't control it, then you create other crises. So, and some of the new terrorist things that we deal with nowadays are not quite as recognizable as an earthquake or a flood or a windstorm. So I think these are appropriate tools. Dr. Higgins and I have talked about the amendments, and those do need to be made, but I do want to provide our support in that, and I think it will make Oregon stronger. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I understand that you're essentially the state acting director or assistant director for FEMA?
Chair Cruz, Representative Anderson, I'm just the deputy director for the State Emergency Management Agency here in Oregon. It's very similar to the Federal Emergency Management.
Okay, statewide. Could you tell me what state you are presently in relationship with the county director of health and the county emergency management in I know this bill will forward that, but at what state of health are we in that area in disseminating information down to the county level?
Chair Cruz, Representative Anderson. Actually, after September 11, 2001, we were in pretty bad shape because most jurisdictions in our state and most around the country really had not significantly addressed the issues of terrorism and all of the different pieces of it. When you talk about dirty bombs and chemical and biological and incendiary devices and whatever else may come up. Since that time, we have formed numerous committees and institutions, just like Dr. Higginson mentioned, with the Health Preparedness Advisory Committee. And we've had a great amount of information, training, exercising, and working with all of our partners, not just the county public health personnel, but county emergency managers, public works, sheriffs, police chiefs, many different groups, mental health providers, because there's a really a large family of people that are involved in this if you really want to make sure that the citizens and the visitors to your state are well protected. So it's an ongoing effort, and I do believe, well, I know for a fact we've been reactionary because anthrax and smallpox have consumed a lot of our time, but we are working very hard to try and address all the issues of terrorism because we've got to be prepared for them all as best we can.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to that as well?
Okay.
And Representative Anderson, the reason I wanted to respond is that I don't know how they did it, but somehow DHHS at the federal level and Centers for Disease Control got money out relatively quickly to us. I mean, the attacks happened in the fall of 2001. By June of 2002, we had money. They've been promising from the federal level, and that appropriation was about $1 billion nationwide. They've been promising for the last couple of years $3.5 billion for first responders, which would directly support a lot of those emergency management activities that you're talking about, but for some reason that continues to be held up in the 03 budget.
And I'd point out, committee members, that shortly after the terrorist attack, Tommy Thompson was in the state, had a series of meetings. I was at one of them, and he did come through on his commitment to get the dollars out relatively quickly, and I would say the ramp up has been incredibly dramatic and incredibly appropriate, and we owe, I think, a lot of gratitude to Secretary Thompson for the fact that he didn't make this a narrow channeled. I mean, he didn't focus this strictly on anthrax and smallpox. He's allowing it to be used for the system, and so it's been a real benefit for us in Oregon. So, any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott. Another person in the building that does extraordinary things to support the Oregon Health Plan.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Medical Association. You would be correct about that. And interestingly enough, just as an aside, if one used one's imagination looking at the definition of this bill, I think you could, in fact, depending on who was the health officer, declare tobacco an impending health crisis as it is provided in the legislation. Mm-hmm. It illustrates one of my points, and this is very serious legislation. We do not take it lightly. Please understand that, first of all. But as we view the bill currently, it is exceedingly vague in the actual implementation and determination of what an impending health crisis might be, and the process by which that would, in fact, be determined. Essentially, it vests under a process plenary authority in the health officer to take actions on an immediate basis that would potentially change practice standards, protocols, and actions of physicians, hospitals, and other healthcare providers on an immediate basis, without a mechanism that I'm aware of to provide earlier planning processes in anticipation of those sorts of activities, and potentially in conflict with practice standards or standards that physicians and others have to meet legally by either their licensing boards or by law and other legal obligations that need to be considered. And it's my understanding that Grant Higginson, who, by the way, is a member of ours, realizes that is an area that we need to address. You would essentially be creating a dual process under this legislation, from the governor's current authority to declare an emergency, which is specifically defined in the law to mean any man-made or natural event or circumstance causing or threatening loss of life, injury to a person or property, and human suffering, versus this is really not a definition as we view it, at least in the bill before you, of declaring an impending public health crisis that may be a threat to the public health, is imminent, likely to be widespread, life-threatening, and of a scope that is beyond the existing response capacity. So, from our view, we believe that this needs to be integrated and coordinated. There should be some mechanism for some review of an action, immediate or otherwise, with input from the medical community in making a determination of that. And some of the questions that you have raised in regard to access to medical records is very legitimate. I mean, this bill provides, as it is currently written, complete authority, in our view, to any medical records at any time and on an immediate basis, which may be the right approach given life as we know it at the moment. But it really does vest incredible authority in the health officer, whom we believe is doing a wonderful job, but we don't know who the health officer may be sometime in the future. It also provides mobilization of volunteer healthcare professionals, which is a positive thing. We do believe that there does need to be a policy adoption that provides some state tort claims protection for those that you are asking to do this work, which they'll do anyway, really. But as a matter of policy, that they should have some assurance that they may not find themselves being sued later down the line after some major biological, chemical, or terrorist attack, which is logical, and that is lodged in another bill. This bill does state that the volunteers would be agents of the state, but there are others who would clearly be employees who would also be providing services under these circumstances, private or otherwise, who might not, in fact, be covered by the language of this bill or the bill that is lodged elsewhere. But our overall point is that this is really a very serious bill. It creates very broad authority, and it really does need some serious consideration of trying to focus it, provide a mechanism for some assurance that the requirements of providers, where they can be fined per incident $500 an incident, in violation of practice standards that may be adopted immediately, is within some context of reasonable parameters. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify. We will work diligently with the Health Division and others, hopefully to clarify some of this authority. The other issue you might want to consider is adding some language, really encouraging the division to seek, to aggressively seek planning funds from the federal government in anticipation of developing protocols or practice standards with appropriate private and public state agencies, so that people can, physicians and others can, in fact, try to anticipate these changes. Thank you very much.
Attorney Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your words, Scott. But what I'd like to know is, I mean, the physicians, OMA, does see the problem that we have, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And yeah. That there's got to be a balance, because when we start having people dying, and if physicians are so intent on maintaining the confidentiality of their patients, I mean, don't you think that there can be a compromise here, or cooperation, or some kind of mechanism developed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morris Anderson, absolutely. But you also have to appreciate that, physicians under current law, federal and otherwise, unless you make some modifications, are violating federal and state statutes of confidentiality, where they may be fined significantly for the release of information that is clearly needed in a public health crisis or a state crisis declared by the governor or otherwise. Now, it sounds silly that you would be in that position when clearly physicians, nurses, hospitals, and others will want to provide the information that will be necessary to prevent or stop a health crisis, whether it's biological, chemical, or disease, or otherwise. But the reality is there are laws on the books that put healthcare providers at jeopardy of violating other statutes, and that should be addressed by the legislation.
And followed, yeah. So, are there a lot of lawsuits for breach of confidentiality? Pretty careful right now, correct?
I believe so. Yes.
Okay. They don't want one more thing to be sued about.
Correct. But, I mean, that's only one aspect of this that you really should look at. I mean, medical records is a critical issue, but think of what it will take to immediately change protocols or practice guidelines as directed by an agency for physicians in a impending health crisis. I mean, that is a major task and requirement, and one that I think would be best worked out as best as you can prior to where you can have appropriate clinical personnel agree that yes, this is the right protocol if we have a particular biological event, for example, and try to mitigate circumstances as best we can for an event that we may not be able to anticipate or have any standards of. But that's why I just think it's very critical that you narrow this a little more clearly about what we are really talking about, because you do have dual tracks in statute currently going with this going on. There's an interstate compact that was proposed by the Department of Justice that was adopted in the first, second, third special session.
Second,
and it was one of those. And one of the things that the Medical Association had proposed, and I'm very pleased that it's kind of coming forward in other legislation, is to provide some liability protection for those that you're asking to volunteer. But we've never addressed, in the bill that's in the other committee on this issue, has never addressed those who, for just their own circumstance, happen to be employed physicians who may in fact be in the business of dealing with these issues, and they would not be have that protection merely because of their practice status. And I just think that's a bad policy. I mean, you are, and physicians and others will do everything they can in this circumstance, but you don't want to expose them unfairly to liability when the interstate compact says that if the governor invites others to come to the state and help in a state emergency, whether it's a terrorist attack or biological attack or otherwise, they are under the State Tort Claims Act. The only people who aren't under the State Tort Claims Act in the same circumstance, if they happen to be health care providers, are those who are in private practice. To me, that is a policy that doesn't make sense. So, we hope to resolve that as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Dr. Higginson can answer this better, but isn't there some kind of mechanism in which public health and physicians are involved with a decision with the governor whenever the governor states a state emergency?
I'm probably not the correct person to answer that, and I know what the form says right above where you sign in, so I don't want to make this up.
We weren't going to make.
Plus, I am the president of the Capital Club, so I don't think it would be a good precedent to be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Melissa Anderson, if I'm understanding the question correctly, are you asking the relationship between the governor and the state public health officer in these sort of crises? Right. Well, first, only the governor could declare this, and the governor would only declare that if there were, very clear evidence provided by the public health agency that there was something of major import that needed to be dealt with. And so there would be, a lot of communication going on. And another thing that Scott brought up earlier was the issue of, it's almost creating a parallel system to OEM, and that clearly was not the intent here, and maybe we need to make some changes there. And one reason that I did want Ken to be up with me is we work very closely together on these things, and in fact, in a biological emergency, I do become the incident commander for OEM system of dealing with things. So, we're all trying to work together, and maybe that needs to be spelled out in the law. And I think Scott makes some other very good points about, we would not be doing treatment guidelines or protocols, just pulling them out of air. These would either be national standards or standards that we would work with the medical and healthcare communities to develop.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I want to say that is my point. We know there are currently standards, and the issue is we should anticipate those as early as we can. And we would never suggest that the governor or the public health officer would take any of these decisions lightly. But you do make a very good point of how that evaluation is determined and whether or not there might be some value to having experts in the medical community as a resource in helping to make that determination if time allows in doing that. Because, again, these are very serious powers, and they are very, very extensive. And I don't think Grant nor anyone can suggest that is, in fact, not the case. Because the governor, under an emergency and under his current powers and under the interstate compact, can take over health care facilities for any purpose, can essentially require health care providers and others to participate under his or her authority in addressing a state of emergency and trying to respond to it. I mean, these are very significant powers. They would be parallel to, World War II authorities under a declaration of war, the kind of authority provided to the president in that sort of circumstance. I mean, it's that sort of power that obviously is used very carefully, but they are very extensive. So you need to think about this.
Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I applaud the willingness of the three groups, emergency management and the public health and the Oregon Medical Association, to work together on this. I think Mr. Gallant is correct that we need to be very careful. I like the idea that you can move quickly. If there's an emergency, let's work to get something that really establishes an immediate response. But on the other hand, and I didn't see this until just a minute ago, there is a definite end to the emergency, too, because that could be a major problem. If it goes on and on and on, the emergency's over, and yet you can access records and do things that could be really detrimental. So I think with the 14 days or with an extension period, that does give some end to this crisis, emergency, whatever. But I applaud you and we'll welcome back anything that you can come that really will negotiate an immediate response and safety for the patient's records.
One of the things that came up in one of the discussions that we participated in was that a mental health provider, when we were talking about access to medical records, said, for example, well, you know, we would like to, if we had a similar circumstance, hopefully we never will, but if we had a similar circumstance in New York, you know, they would like to have access to all of the relatives and family members' records to make a determination whether or not they would need counseling and assistance. And it just seemed to me as though that's a little broad authority in just kind of automatically authorizing that sort of access, where we clearly knew who was impacted in New York. They had every ability to seek medical help, whether it was psychiatric, physical, or mental health counseling, or otherwise. Again, you have to think through some of these things. In our view, it's important to have access to records for the specific purposes of which you have to deal with an immediate threat, clearly. But you have to have some caution about just opening these things to someone who wants to do the right thing, but may not actually be what the individual really wants to have happen. And it's like, and to whom do you share the records the health division ends up having access to? I know Grant is serious about, well, we would never share it with anyone without making sure that it was confidential. But to whom do you send all of these records? And how do you assure that, in fact, they are maintained confidentially for the purpose of dealing with a biological or some other communicable disease or whatever? I don't see that in consideration of the legislation. So it's very complex in how you lay this space, giving appropriate authority to act without going too far in that process.
I agree, and I think we need to be very, very careful how we proceed here, but I'm also incredibly concerned with with, I think, more kind of overarching all of this is violation of HIPAA. And I'm wondering if it might not be a good idea once this work group that we're going to put together here comes up with a product, if it might be prudent to have an AG's opinion on that for an added piece of protection.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a really good idea. And actually, one thing I should recognize is Keith Cutler from Department of Justice is here. He helped a lot with the original work on identifying those issues. He's been involved in this all along. We were just saying that Keith should be a part of this work group as we're trying to work this through.
I'm not sure
if Keith is the right person to work on the HIPAA part of things, but I'm sure he can get that reviewed by the correct person in the Department of Justice.
And Mr. Chairman, we have one of our counsels is probably the expert on all things HIPAA, and as you know, this committee moved a bill just last week to Judiciary right. Committee, and I will inquire whether there is already some consideration in that legislation as it relates to these things. But we'd be more than happy to volunteer our resources to try to address that.
And Scott, that's appreciated, but I think at the end of the day, having an opinion from the AG, I think it would be appropriate with this action. So thank you very much.
We will
charge you to
go forth and do good things.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2251, and we are adjourned. Still watches wrong.
Yeah.